Hey everyone, welcome to our Build 2016 Code Labs. This one is the introduction to Unity. We had a whole bunch of different labs this year for Build 2016. We had IoT labs, web dev labs, game dev labs. So this is the one specific to Unity. You can find the code for this lab at aka.ms/UnityBuildCodeLab. Feel free to follow along. I'm Adam Tulliper, a technical evangelist with Microsoft. I have a real passion for game dev technologies, love doing game dev, love playing games too, of course. You can find me online a whole bunch of different places or conferences around you. Twitter at Adam Tulliper, or you can find me on my blog, adamtulliper.com. Or if you have any questions about anything you see, feel free to reach out to me, adamt@microsoft.com. Although typically the best way to get in touch with me is with Twitter, because then it's out in the open for the world to see, and maybe I can answer a question for you that would help somebody else as well. With that, let's get started. The game that we're going to be building out today is called Orcs with Forks and Knives. And this can be found in the Code Labs for Game Dev 1. And I have a URL created that will actually take you right to the game, to all the Code Labs from Build 2016. And that's aka.ms/BuildCodeLabs. In here, you'll see there's Office Labs, there's the Web, IoT. All these are really great labs. In here, you'll find the Game Dev 1. Unity intro. Now notice there's several other in the game dev track. There's Angle, Monogame, there's another Unity for Windows 10. This one we're going to be doing the game dev one, so make sure you grab the right source code. Once you go to the repository, you can grab all of the, download it, either in GitHub Desktop if you've downloaded it, install it, which is a nice utility that will track kind of everything on your system. And I just changed my resolution, so the display looks a little bit goofy on this right now. Or you can just download the zip file here. Once you have that downloaded inside of Unity, you can just simply do an open and point to the folder location. But before we do that, let me show you the actual folder location here, because in it we have images and then we have source, begin and end. So this project that we're going to start with today in the video is of course going to be the begin project. Now you'd have a couple ways of doing this. You can navigate in Unity to either just open to this project, or if you've downloaded my little registry add-in script, you can right click on begin and say open as Unity project. Now what does that do? If you go to my blog on adamtulliper.com, or if you just search for in your favorite search engine, Open Unity 5 Project with right click on folder. I've got just a little registry script here that's actually hosted out on my GitHub. And you just take that, save as a .reg file, and import it into your registry, and it will show up as a right click open as Unity Project. Fun little quick tip, since I always work a lot with folders that I decompress, I just want to right click and open them. So this works well for that. All right, here we go. And when you first open it up, there's an error down here, controller hero transition, which does not exist. And that's okay. We're going to be fixing that error. That is by design. And before we get rolling this, let's go back to the browser here real quick. The prior lab that ideally you should take before going to this, although you don't have to, either one works just fine first, is over on Microsoft Virtual Academy. We have a building blocks game development. And that can also be found at aka.ms/UnityStart. So again, that was aka.ms/UnityStart. That will bring you right to the course. We're going to touch upon a couple of these subjects today, but this goes into much greater detail. Game objects, architecture, prefabs, coding, animation, physics, and Unity's UI system user interface. So definitely check this course out either before or after. I think it'll be well worth your time. Keep in mind that in the lab that we're going to go through, everything is documented out on the GitHub site. Every step, 1, 2, 3, all the way on down. So everything that we're going to talk about today is documented. I know some folks like to watch a video and kind of see the interactions a little bit better than might be written down. But either way, if you want something to follow along, go check out the directions. And this is really the order that we're going to go in. So let's get started on that with task number one, opening the project and the scene. Now I already opened up the Unity project, and I'm going to open up scene one. I typically store my scenes in assets scenes folder, although they can go anywhere and you can drag and drop them wherever you want inside of the project window here. So for example, if you wanted to move them somewhere else, you could go ahead and do that. Another scene setting I like doing right out of the box is edit project settings editor. And I like making sure that asset serialization mode is set to force text. Why do I like to do that? Well, one of the best reasons is if someone goes to check something in the source control, I can simply take any conflicts and diff them easily. So, for example, if I just take these two files, and now I know these are separate scene files, but you'll just see that we have a YAML file format, and we can just come in here and essentially diff what the differences are. So if you don't do that, the scenes by default will be a binary format, and you'll have no idea what's in there. You can't tell if somebody changed the position and what the changes were. It'd be very, very difficult. All right, so back in scene 01, the first thing that we want to do over here is get the camera setting correct. Now, this is a 2D project. A 2D project is really just a thin plane in a 3D world, so it's still a 3D system. Unity is, always was, and will be a 3D-based system, so 2D is just fixing the camera's X and Y. Now, all we need to do for this particular camera here is note that this is an orthographic camera. We have two different camera modes. We have orthographic and perspective. Orthographic gives you a fixed viewport all the way out. So if I go out of 2D mode and if I look at what a 2D camera looks like, I'm sorry, an orthographic camera looks like, you'll notice it doesn't scale with distance. If I look at perspective, we have this cone of vision. See things just like we do. Things get scaled and skewed with distance, and something that's closer will look bigger than something that's farther away. With orthographic, everything remains the same. Now, this is great for 2D projects, although if you want something like parallax where background is moving at a different speed than the foreground, you might need a script to do it manually. Whereas perspective, it's very easy to do. You stick something in the background, you stick something in the foreground, and they move at different rates. So the other thing that we can do here is with an orthographic camera, we can specify the size. And orthographic camera size will always guarantee you that the height will stay the same regardless of whatever resolution device that you're finally running on. So it doesn't matter if you're on a phone, laptop, Xbox, etc. Whatever your resolution is, you'll be guaranteed that this is going to be the height that you're going to be looking at. The only thing that will change is the actual width here. And we can see that when I scale things in and out, the width changes, but the height does not. So find a happy setting here for the orthographic camera size. Sometimes it might seem like a pain to switch back and forth between the scene tab and the game tab. Of course, our scene tab is our design surface here. Our game tab is where we're going to run our game. So if I click on play, we can see our game running here. Make sure you get out of play mode after you run your game. I also have mine set to maximize on play. If I don't maximize, notice I get in this window, but I can switch back and forth and still actually design my game while it's running. Any of those changes, though, will be lost. So, for example, if I duplicate my player and create a couple players, as soon as I get out of play mode, that's gone. So, what I like to do is change my project settings, or I'm sorry, my preferences, edit preferences to make the colors play mode tint, something like some shade of red, or whatever color that you like. Just click on a color, exit out again. Now, when you click on play, notice that the UI will change and you'll know you're in play mode. In other words, don't make changes here, they will be lost. Any changes you make to assets on disk, though, will be saved. This is only for scene-based changes. If you're going to modify something over here, those changes will not be kept. All right, back to our main camera setting here. Find a size that works for you. If you don't like this particular view, you can always change your layout. So in this case, maybe I want a 2x3. So I can see both my scene view, so I can change my camera size. Let's go to camera, change my size here, and I can kind of see the effect of it. So find something that works well, depending on the resolution you want, the size. You have to figure that out there. So I'm going to choose just 13 for this particular demo, and then switch back to my default view. Let's zoom back a little bit, and let's run it and see what it looks like. All right, cool. So I've got my player here. Notice once I start attacking, the attacks never stop. I can die as it stands currently. And there we go. All dead. Once I'm dead, level fades out, restarts again. Now we notice our hierarchy over here is pretty much a mess. So our next task is to organize our hierarchy. Task number two is going to be pretty simple. I'm going to create a game object, an empty game object, under the game object, create empty menu. And rename this game object to be enemies. over on the right-hand side in the inspector window and hit enter when I'm done, because if you click away, the rename will not accept. Now this is just a game object. It can be a placeholder. The only properties it has is really this transform, which has a position, rotation, and scale. It has a tag, a name, and a layer. The best use for these type of empty game objects are either spawn points or some sort of placeholder slash container. And they can really help organize your hierarchy over here. So for example, all of my orcs and my goblin here, they're enemies. If I just highlight them, and you can control click or just click on the first one, hold down shift, click on the last one, just like you would do in Explorer to select your files, select them and just drag and drop them right onto enemies here. There we go. That's folded up on their enemies. And I have some other environment pieces here that I'm just going to click on and drag into the environment game object I've already created in the base project that you have. So I've just selected the walls and I've dragged and dropped those onto environment. And there we go. Now we have our player, our camera, the UI event system, and the canvas for the UI, our game controller, just kind of orchestrate a couple things in our game, controller health bar and the text on the screen. Then we have all of our environment pieces and our enemies. I'm going to save that. Save early, save often. Your scenes do not auto-save, so make sure you save all the time. It's always good practice. Get used to Control-S in any software product that you're working on. There's some scripts you can get out there that will actually, anytime you click on play, will save your scene for you. So if you like that workflow, I've never found it necessary, knock on wood, because I save my changes all the time. All right, we're cruising along now. Task number 3 is complete. That was just simply organizing a hierarchy. Now we're going to move on to task number 4, which is going to be bringing in some of the level pieces and working with prefabs. And in order to do that, under the Assets Sprites folder, there's a couple ones that are kind of notable here. We've got the floors, and notice this is essentially your floor top, your tile plan. Then underneath the Assets Sprites Walls folder, we have a couple different layouts. And because of this perspective, notice the top of the window here has the centerpiece, and then to the left of the centerpieces, the wall pieces are angled to the left, and to the right of the centerpiece, they're angled to the right. And if we look at the bottom piece, we kind of have a similar type of situation where they're angled in different directions. So make sure you get the right angles here. On our bottom piece here, walls left bottom, walls right top, walls right bottom. So this kind of tells you where to go. So if you want to make this level essentially longer over here, we can drag in a left bottom piece. And make sure, of course, you're in 2D mode, the little 2D button on the toolbar. This is a 2D project. And I'll take a quick moment and just mention that a 2D project is Edit, Project Settings, Editor, and it has a default behavior mode of 2D. When you do File, New Project inside of Unity, here you have the choice of 3D or 2D. The changes that that makes for you is if you choose 2D, it makes it so your camera is set up to an orthographic camera by default. It also makes it that your artwork, when you import it, is something that you can drag and drop into your scene. So if I simply click on a piece of artwork here and let's see, I want this guy, the corner piece. If I look at this artwork here, which is this sprite, this is a texture type sprite. Normally, if you're in a 3D project and you drag and drop PNG images or any kind of images into your project, they will come in as a texture. And a texture, you cannot drag and drop into your scene. Textures are meant to be applied to like a 3D object. So in this particular case, these textures come in as a special type called a sprite that allows you to drag and drop them in. It's one of the important changes that gets set up when you do a 2D project. All right, so back to our walls here. Let's just assume that we want to build this out a little bit more. So bring this one in, and then I will just Control D to duplicate it. Although I could just soon drag another one in. Now getting these kind of lined up, there's a trick here. I can move it really close, which is kind of a pain, or I can hold down V, V for vertex. And as soon as I do that, we can see this changes to wherever the mouse pointer is, it highlights the closest vertex or point, plus we get the center point. So vertex snap means click near one of these points that's highlighting when you're holding the V key down and snap it to another piece. So I want to take this circle here and snap it right over there. It's going to snap it to the closest vertex that it finds. So I'm going to, again, hold down V, move my mouse over while still holding down V, click, and move. And you notice as I move it around, it snaps to whatever vertices it finds around it. So I'll do that the same one here. I'm just going to move this up a bit, hold down V. And if you click on the wrong one, like for example, if you click in the center vertex here, you'll notice your snappings kind of snap to the center of your object. So be mindful of which one is highlighting when you move your mouse around while holding V. It takes a couple tries to get used to, but once you do, it's an extremely powerful tool. So draw your level out like you want, but there's an important point here that's really a difference with these other walls that are here. If I look at this wall that I've just dragged and dropped up, this is simply a sprite renderer. This is how a 2D image, a sprite, is drawn to the screen. This has no physics properties, meaning that one of these orcs can just go la da 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 da, go walking through this wall at any point in time. My player, if I wanted to, could just go walking right through that wall as well. So there's nothing stopping that. For example, if I go to the top of the screen here and I move, notice I can't go through that top wall there. So what we need to do is make this wall like the other walls. And notice on these walls, all they have on them are box colliders. So that tells the physics system, hey, nothing can pass through this object. This is essentially a stationary object that has this box area around it that we're going to hit and not move. Box collider 2D. Don't confuse it with a regular box collider, which is used for like a 3D box. Now I can do this to each one. I could add on a box collider 2D, and that would work just fine, but that seems like a lot of repeated tasks. So I'm going to go ahead and delete what I just did and what you probably just did, and look underneath the prefabs folder because I've already created some prefabricated units. In fact, even before I use those, why don't I show you how to create those? Let me undo. Great thing is Unity has a multi-level undo system, so I'm just going to Control Z, undo what I did, and now I have these objects with box collider on them. I'm just going to create a prefab in my root folder here because I'm going to delete it anyway. I just want to show you the process. Creating a prefab is just clicking on the object that you like, and you want to create a reusable object. It's going to be reusable in this scene. It's going to be reusable across any of the scenes in this particular project. So all you need to do is click on it here in your hierarchy, drag it to your project folder, and let go. Boom. That's a prefab. It now highlights blue to let you know this is a prefab, and you get a couple new options with that prefab. This prefab menu shows up here. Select, revert, apply. Select, which you can also do by right-clicking or clicking there. Select prefab simply says, show me who I made from. Show me this prefab. You can drag and drop these till your heart's content. The revert means any changes that you've made to this object, maybe you stretched it out, and you want it to go back to its original prefab state, so it's just like this guy here in your project. You just click on revert, and it discards any of your custom changes to that object. Now, on the flip side, we can do something cool with prefabs. If we want this object to be bigger, for example, notice if I scale the one in my project, all of them scale. That's the great thing about a prefab. If you have 100 zombies in your game, do they each need to be customized and created separately? Nope. You have one zombie, and that's kind of like your pre-configured zombie, your prefab, and you can either create them at runtime through the instantiate call, or you just drag and drop into your scene till your heart's content. All right, the last property of a prefab I want to talk about real quick is if you have customized this object here. For example, we've taken the scale to 2.2. If we want this to push down to this prefab and then apply to every other prefab, every other instance that comes from this object, we can just click on apply. And again, that will take our custom changes, write them to this object, which will then in turn affect any other prefab instance that stems from this guy. So let me click apply. Notice they all update now. And notice the other thing is too that's tricky and you have to keep in mind here is if I do undo, I've already written these changes to this asset here. That I cannot undo. So I have to be careful about that. I'm going to go ahead and undo that particular change there just by manually typing it and applying it. There we go. So that's how you create a prefab. I'm going to go and delete these guys and delete these ones because I've already created some prefabs for you in this project in the prefabs folder. You can find that we have all of our walls here, left top, left bottom. And if we look at that when we drag and drop, that already has the box collider on it. And then we can just snap that in place and drag another one up and snap that into place. And you get the idea. Now notice I'm clicked in the center, so I'm getting this goofy movement here. There we go. So take a moment, draw out your level, and then we will be done with this particular task. For task number 5, we're going to be reading basic input and moving a player. In order to do that, we should go to the Scenes, Simple Player. And this is literally a simple example. We have the player character in here. And if I play and move, the character does not actually move. So we have a problem with that, and we need to fix that. And so in order to do that, what we need to do is find the code that's on the player. And if you look on the actual player game object and scroll down, you'll see there's a simple player script. If you double-click on it right here, it'll open it up. Or if you single-click it, it'll show you where it is in your project. This is just a code preview on the right-hand side. It doesn't allow you to edit it. So I'm going to double-click it to open it up in Visual Studio. Now notice this class inherits from mono behavior. All of your Unity code that is on a game object inherits from mono behavior, and as such, it has special rules. There are no constructors in these classes. That's not how the Unity object lifecycle works for the code that is on a game object. You can surely have other classes, other C# classes in a project that have constructors, and you can call them from within this code, no problem. It's just that your code that exists on a game object must inherit from mono behavior. And that's how it understands what a game object is and its life cycle. And so when it starts up, there's two events you can use. You can use start or awake. And awake is typically used for the object's own constructor, in a sense. If you have things that you want to do early on before other game objects will communicate with this object, you do it in awake. If you do it later on, it's possible that at that point in time, somebody else has already communicated with this particular game object. They've gotten a reference to it. They've called some functions on it. In this case, we're not doing that. In this case, it's pretty simple. We're just going to keep everything in start. And what we do is we cache a reference to the components. What components are on our player? Let's go back over here. Click on the player. And notice the player has, it's a game object, so it has the name and transform. The player also has a sprite renderer. As I mentioned, it's responsible for drawing this 2D image out to the scene, to the screen, I should say. There's an animator component, which is in charge of actually animating this character and playing through its different sprites. There's a rigid body. A rigid body is used for physics. A rigid body gives an object mass. And if you want it to be under the influence of gravity, you can do that as well. In this particular project, edit project settings, physics 2D, notice I've shut off gravity, which is normally -9.81 in the Y, and I've turned it into 0. So there is no gravity in this game, which makes sense because it's really top down, and Y is up and down, and our left and right, our horizontal, is X. So in our 2D game, if I actually had gravity right now, our character would start falling downwards, and we don't want that. So I've shut gravity off here. But back to our player, our rigid body gives the object mass, and when we move an object, we move it through its rigid body. Now, one thing that you might want to check out online is just a quick reference here to our game dev show. Game dev. If you just look for game dev show, you'll find it on channel 9. So channel9.msdn.com/shows/game dev. And I have two shows out there. I have a physics in Unity, which is essentially part 1. And then I have that's Game Dev Show 14, episode 14. And then I have Game Dev Show episode 16, which I actually just published. And that's an introduction to physics part 2. So if you want to see really what the rigid bodies are all about, and what these different settings are, like interpolate, check those out. So when we move this object, we're going to move its rigid body. We could move an object via its transform. We could say, hey, your position is now 10, 10, 10. But what that does is it immediately teleports the object from its current location to its destination location. That's bad because it doesn't take physics into consideration. We really want to use the physics system to really drag or move an object from point A to point B and understand if there are any collisions along the way. So in order to do that, we're going to read some input and use the rigid body component. So we need to move it through this component. How do we get that? If we go back to our code here, when we start up, we are asking for that component. We're asking Unity that go ahead and look at whatever game object this code is on, which happens to be the player. Whatever game object this code is on, look at its components and find the rigid body 2D, which is this guy right here. Unity will parse down its components, say, oh, I found the rigid body 2D. I'm going to give you a reference to it in code. And we also do the same thing for the animator. In this particular demo, we are just working with a rigid body. Now, update is tied, or I should say, input is tied to our update method. And what that means is as you read input from the keyboard or the mouse, that happens in sync with how your update method is being called. If your game is running 60 frames a second, this method is being called 60 times a second. And it's important to check for your update like we're going to do here. There are some exceptions. And when I say here, what do I mean? As opposed to what else? Notice there's a fixed update call here. And again, I go into this in greater detail in those physics courses, but a fixed update is tied to the physics system. The update is tied to the drawing system. Two different systems inside of Unity. One is in charge of drawing stuff to the screen, one is in charge of calculating physics, and they run at different rates. By default, your physics system runs at 50 physics frames a second, which is different than your drawing frames. So basically, just 50 ticks a second, it calculates the physics calls. And if you try to read a button in here or a key down, it's possible you can miss it because it's actually tied to this particular function, update. So any of that kind of input you should read there. There are some exceptions. I've seen folks that will read their horizontal and vertical input in fixed update, but as a general best practice, read your input inside of update. So what we're going to do is we've already got two floats defined, a private float horizontal, private float vertical. And you'll notice I try to stick to the standard C# naming conventions that you find across most of the C# world. Unity, I believe, because there's been Unity Script, their version of JavaScript, Boo, and so a couple different languages, including C#, that at one point in time or another you could write your Unity projects in. You see different naming conventions that Unity internally will use. So, for example, the current game object dot transform is all its properties are lowercase, which in C# typically you'll find those to be uppercase. So I stick to the standard C# naming conventions. I don't adhere to what the folks internally at Unity have done on their own naming conventions because they have supported multiple languages in their API. So with that out of the way, get the rigid body. Let's go ahead and read our input here, and we can say horizontal is equal to input.getAxis horizontal, and I'll explain what those words are in a second. Vertical is equal to input.getAxis, and we're going to do vertical. And in this particular case, we're not actually even doing the fire, so we're going to skip the input.get button down. But if that was the case, I could do something like this just to show you. Private bool fire. And then down here, I would just simply say if input.get button down of fire one, fire is equal to true. Otherwise, fire is equal to false. And actually, I wouldn't even do this here. What I would do is when I consume the fire, when I use this fire variable, whoever's going to use it, then I would have them set it to be false. When I did the else statement there, I was just kind of coding off a pattern, so to say. I actually don't need an else there. Wherever I would use the fire to play my animation, then I would choose that. In fact, even right here, sometimes you might even just say animator.setBool attack true, for example. That tells the animation system you are performing something called, there's a variable called attack, and you're going to set that value to true. But anyway, we are not doing that in this demo, so I'm kind of You might be scratching your head going, what is he talking about at this point in time? Let's stick to the script here, shall we? We're reading our horizontal and vertical values here, and they're floats. They will be a value from negative 1 to positive 1. And if you're not touching anything on the keyboard, they're 0. So it makes it kind of easy. Now what we need to do in fixed update is change the velocity of our object. So we can say the rigid body component that we've got, we can set its point in time velocity, not its acceleration, its velocity. So when we set the velocity, boom, that will be its velocity in meters per second. What is velocity? It is a vector 2. If we happen to be dealing with a 3D project, it would be a vector 3. So we're going to set it to a new vector 2. And don't let this term vector fool you. They are pretty simple concepts. And they can be used for a whole bunch of things, distances, lighting calculations. So they can get more complex. In this particular case, we're simply using it to represent two values, x and the y. That is it. So we're going to create a new vector 2, and our x value is going to be whatever we read in for our horizontal, and our y value is going to be whatever we read for our vertical. So it's a real generic character controller, but it's really easy to understand. Typically, you'll also see this get multiplied by a speed value too. So let me create a private int speed. Oops, sorry, make that public int speed. And we'll set its default value to say 5. Great. Why am I creating a public integer there? And how does this differ than the private? Who can set this and why are you doing this? Well, if you make it public, it immediately will show up in Unity's interface after it compiles. That's what this little spinny thing in the right-hand corner is. If you missed that, I'll just enter, save it, come back to Unity, and notice this little spinny thing right there. That means your code's compiling, so your interface is hung while it's doing that. But on my simple player script now, notice the speed. I can see the default value of 5 there. I could change it and override it. It doesn't change my code. It just, in memory at runtime, changes the default value. And let's go ahead and see what happens. I'm moving slow, and I want to move faster, but what I didn't do was multiply my input by speed. So I'm still moving kind of slow down here. And in order to speed that up, I just multiply it by that variable that we just created there called speed. So multiply horizontal and vertical by speed, and we should be really 5 times faster now. There we go. Perfect. Cool. All right, that's it. Real simple basic character controller. We read our input, just as a recap. We read our axis, horizontal and vertical, and then we apply that to our rigid body. Now, one thing I did say I would talk about is where these values come from. Horizontal, vertical, fire one. What does that mean? Well, there's an input system inside of Unity you can find under Edit, Project Settings, Input. And when you expand this, there's a whole bunch that are set up out of the box. You can change these. And they can get more complicated too as you add support for different controllers, like the Xbox controller, and you want to support, keyboard, mouse, different controllers, joysticks. But out of the box, you'll always see horizontal, vertical, and fire one there. Horizontal, it's a text. You could name it something different if you wanted to. It's a string. And so when we ask for that axis, we say, give me something called horizontal. Unity comes over here and says, okay, this is tied to a negative and positive button of left and right arrows, or the alternate buttons, they call them buttons, of A and D. So the gaming keys, right? Left and right, A and D, or your arrows, left and right. Vertical, it's another string that is tied to down arrow, up arrow, S and W. Perfect. So that's how we define what horizontal means as a string that we can ask for. It's going to simply look for left and right, keys being down. Same thing with vertical and fire one maps to your left control button or your left mouse button 0. That's our input system. So as long as you're sticking to the basics here, it's actually really, really easy. And again, those values, when you're not doing anything, are 0. And for horizontal and vertical, and when you hold down like the left arrow, it goes to negative 1. And when you hold down the right arrow, it quickly ramps up from 0 to positive 1. And you can change how fast it cycles from 0 to positive 1 through the sensitivity settings there. All right, Control S, I'm going to save my scene. And that is it for this particular task. For task number six, I kind of jumped ahead of myself a little bit on task number five. For task number six, we're going to take our simple player here and make this player be able to attack. So this is going to use the animation system. Let's talk about what that is first. If I highlight my player and I look under the components here, we have an animator component, which is also called Unity's Mechanim animation system. There's two animation systems. There's the legacy animation system, and you'll see there's actually an animation component, which is kind of like the legacy component. So I avoid that and I use the animator. There's an animation controller, which is essentially this flowchart that tells us how we can go between animations. Now we can create our animations pretty easily inside of Unity using our sprites. We can drag and drop. Those have already been set up for this task. However, there is a future task where we actually will create a brand new walk animation. So bear with me for now. Just assume that these animations have already been set up. What we need to figure out is how to transition between our idle. It's orange. That's our default state. If we click on play, we can see our player is playing the idle animation. If we look at the animator component, we can see that we're playing idle over and over and over again. The trick is we need to go from idle to attack. And what's been set up here are these arrows. If we right-click on an animation and we say make a transition, we can dock these arrows to other animations. We can say, all right, we want to move from idle to attack. And once we've created this arrow, we can click on that arrow and define what exactly that means. How do we know when to go from idle to attack? And we use parameters. They're nothing more than variables that we create to go from one animation to another via these transitions. So I've created a trigger called attack. And think of that as a Boolean value. And we all know from programming what a Boolean value is. A trigger acts like a Boolean value that when you set the trigger, it becomes true. And then whenever something uses that trigger, like the animation system, which is what we're working in, and this is specific to the animation system, when the animation system uses that variable to trigger off one of these transitions and then sets it back to false again so it's ready to go. This is a great use case for something like jump and attack, where they're literally like one-hit animations. They're just one shot. You play them and then come back and we're ready to go again. If you don't do that, you'd have to really track when you are attacking. You'd have to know when to set a value true, and then you would have to know when you're done attacking and set that value back to false again. It's a lot of variable management that's kind of a pain to do. So I've created this thing called a trigger for attack, and it's not checked off by default, so its value is false. And if I click on the transition between idle and soldier attack, and I scroll down a little bit, there's this thing called conditions here, which by default will be empty. I've added a condition, and you can specify what makes this transition happen. And I've simply said when attack is triggered, in other words, when in code, when I set this value to be true, in code, go ahead and go from idle to attack. And this will play the attack animation. And when I'm done, let's look at our arrow going back. Let's go ahead and we can actually remove this. We play our attack animation, and once we're done playing our attack animation, we go right back to idle. That makes sense. Now, there's one thing here that you'll find out of the box that's a little bit goofy with animations. When we go from idle to attack, by default, you'll have this has exit time checked off. And has exit time means that you need to play a certain amount of this idle transit, idle animation before you are allowed to leave it and go to attack. That's good in the case of something like a jump, where we need to complete a jump animation, or when we're attacking and we need to complete an attack animation. But if I'm sitting here idle, I want to be able to leave idle at any point in time. And so in animations like that, where I'm saying I want this to be interruptible at any point in time, uncheck has exit time, and its transition duration is zero. In other words, how long will it take to go from this animation to this animation? Now, this makes more sense when you're doing 3D animations, because a transition duration you can specify. Let's say you are running and then jumping. Unity will actually morph your animations together. It'll take your animation data for your 3D character and say, all right, you are running and going to jumping. How long should that transition time last where we move between running to jumping? In 2D, that makes no sense because, of course, they can't blend our 2D images together. That would look like garbage. It doesn't know what the frames of our 2D images look like. And so it's a little bit misleading. So I always turn that to zero, transition duration, and uncheck exit time here. However, that's different. Once I play attack, I want my entire attack animation to play. And so notice after when I'm going from attack to idle, I check off has exit time. And what is my exit time? If we mouse over this, it says the exit time and normalized time from the current state. Normalized values go from 0 to 1. And so this is basically, think of it as a percent, 0 to 100%. How much percentage of my attack animation must play before I'm allowed to go back to idle? And this says 100%. So in other words, as soon as I go to attack, I have to play the entire attack animation before I am allowed to go back to idle, which makes sense. So save those changes. And then I'm going to go back to code and kind of work on what we did previously here in that simple player script. Input dot get button down, fire one. And earlier I had talked about setting a boolean, but what we actually need here is set trigger. What was the name of our trigger? That's the variable name. We can simply look back in Unity and see that it was called attack. It's under this parameters tab here, not the default layers tab, this little parameters tab. And that is the transition that's being used from idle to attack, and I can scroll down and verify that. It's listed right there. So as soon as attack is set, in other words, it's triggered, I'll make that transition. So let's finish off the code here. That's it. It's super easy. When you press the left mouse button, tell the animation system to go ahead and set that value to true, which will then cause us to go from idle to attack, and then immediately we'll set that value back to false again, so it's reusable again in the future. We'll play through the attack animation, come back to idle. Let's see this at work here. Let me pop this window out so we can keep an eye on that. Run this, and there we go. We're idle, idle, idle. Let me press the mouse button. There we go. And now, if you're tricky, I don't know if I can be able to do this in time. Let's see. Left mouse button. I'm going to press my control button and then click pause. All right. Just so you can see what's going on here. I'll do a scene so I can zoom in here. Now I'm part of the way through attack, and I can frame advance. You can see as I'm stepping through the frames, I'm getting multiple game frames per animation frame. But notice now that I'm like about 70% through the animation. There we go. As soon as I was done, notice now we're going right back to idle here, and idle's playing. There we go. If I press it again, you can see we just go right there and back. Now, if I hold the mouse button down, it doesn't do anything, which is by design because I'm using input.get button down, not input.get button, which will actually work if you repeatedly hold it down. And you can see the value get set there. You'll see this little radio box tick. Or you should see that tick. It just did a second ago. There we go. It happens really fast. It's because it's getting consumed super fast. Let me try it in the beginning here. There we go. If I do it really fast, you'll see it kind of light up. It's just because it's getting cleared so fast, you're not seeing it. So I'm clicking the mouse like crazy. I don't know if you can hear me clicking. All right. So that task is done. Simple way to trigger off an animation. And again, in one of the future tasks, we're going to actually create an animation. This one just dealt with how we transition from here to here, and how we set those variables in the animation system. In other words, the parameters. And we can do this for other types. We saw that in the animation system, we can create a float int bool trigger. And our API, if we do set, we can see set trigger, bool, float, integer, and triggers in there. All the other ones are unrelated API calls that don't deal with those parameters. Cool. Easy enough, hopefully. Let's go on to the next one. For task 7, we need to be able to make the player pick up a coin. As it stands right now, when the player runs over a coin, nothing happens. You'll see right here, We go over coin, nothing happens. So in the physics system in Unity, we can specify a coin has a collider or a trigger. A collider means that when you hit this object, you're going to stop. And we can demo that really quickly by adding a circle collider 2D on this first coin here. And as soon as I run over that coin, let me get rid of this orc. Notice, I should say second coin, it was my second coin. As I drop down on it, I can't get past it. So that's because it's a circle collider. It's this immovable static object that's just sitting there. Well, that's all well and good, but it kind of doesn't suit what we want to do in the game. You don't run across the board in your game and get stopped by every piece of coin. It's treasure. You pick it up. And so in order to do that, we have a special type of a collider called a trigger. And recall that a collider is simply the area that it defines to the physics system, what this object looks like. And when I added the circle collider, notice the region, the circle was down there, offset a little bit. So I'll probably want to just fix that up, move the X and the Y, and make the radius a little bit bigger. And if you're wondering what on earth I'm doing here, if you click on any name in front of a numeric value here, so for example, if I click on radius, it becomes this invisible scroll bar. So I'm going to take the circle and make it about the size of this coin here. Now this comes from a prefab. I can tell because it's blue. If I right click on it and select prefab, there's my coin. So what I want to do is take these settings and write them back to this coin. Now I could very well go to this coin and add a circle collider here, but I want one in my scene that I can work with and kind of see how it looks on here. But there's also another scenario here. We don't want to run into it and stop. So we've got a circle collider. Its collider region is adjusted okay. I'm going to save my changes. But I want to make this collider a trigger. So we check off is trigger. And what that will do is only notify you in code when the player touches this object. Again, it will not stop your object. It will not participate in the physics simulation going on. If you drop something on it, it will just pass right through it. So that's what we want. We want the character to be able to run right through it, but I want Unity to tell my code, hey, something has just touched this object, or to tell my player, hey, you just touched an object. So I'm going to click on Apply to push the change down to my prefab and up through all the rest of the coin instances in my scene. If I spot test a couple, there we go, circle collider, it's a trigger, circle collider, it's a trigger. There we go. If we look at our base prefab here, it's a circle collider with a trigger. So again, I just modified one in my scene, and I clicked Apply. Our coins are all set up now. What we need to do next is look at our player code, because the player has the actual code on there. Actually, even before we do that, let's talk one other thing. Notice on our coin, it's super basic. We have on this coin, there's a particle system, so it kind of gives it this glow. The coin image itself, just a sprite renderer. And the root game object, which is what has a circle collider, also has a pickup properties script on it. That is nothing more than a POCO class, a plain old CLR object that has a public int health amount, public int coin amount. The reason we do this is this assigns how much this coin is worth to each instance of our coin. Two public properties, they show up in Unity's editor. So if I click on a coin, the coin amount is 10, the health amount is 0. So that says that when I pick up this object, I'm going to get 10 coins. It's worth 10 coins. And we'll see how we can figure those values out in 1 second here. Because our pickup code is in our player. So click on your player, and on the components, find the player controller. The code that controls the player. I called it player controller. Now in here, this is a model behavior class, just like we talked about before. I know that because I'm running over a trigger, I need to implement a method called onTriggerEnter, or if I want to know when I leave that trigger, onTriggerExit, or if I want to know when I'm still touching that trigger, onTriggerStay. And since this is a 2D game, they're actually onTriggerEnter2D. And you can see all those method declarations. If you right-click and you choose Implement Mono Behaviors, this is the Visual Studio Tools for Unity at its finest. This tells you all the Unity-specific methods that you can implement in this class. So if I say OTE, in other words, on trigger enter, OTE. Click on trigger enter, and notice I can see right here on trigger enter, On trigger exit, on trigger exit 2D. Well, hey, wait a minute here. Why don't I have the other methods here like on trigger enter 2D? That's because I already have them in this class. Four already implemented. Cool. If I wanted to implement it, I could just check it off on trigger exit 2D, say okay, and it would generate that code for me with the proper method signature. And as soon as my player was no longer touching a trigger, it would call this code. I don't need that in this case. In this particular case, I only want on trigger enter. I can just look for enter 2D, and I've already implemented the on trigger enter 2D code here. This is a standard method signature. Unity will look for a method in your class with this definition whenever you come across an object with a trigger. Now your object should have a rigid body and a collider. You're a moving object and you are now coming in contact with this trigger. And on trigger enter will actually be called on both game objects that participated in the trigger, provided that this code exists on both game objects. In this case, it doesn't. I only have this code on the player, so only the player cares about picking up an object. Unity gives us a collision object. It has information about the collision. And from the API, we can simply ask for the game object we just collided with. That's collision.gameObject. And just like if you've ever done any old school programming, like going back to, you know, any of the Visual C++ or C Sharp, I think Visual C++, my memory might be failing me now. I know Visual Basic, .NET, you could do a tag on an object, like in WinForms, for example, I believe in WPF. So a tag was just a text string you could apply to an object. And it's the same concept in Unity. You apply a text string and you check for its value. So here we're saying if the tag of the object we've collided with is coin, we're going to do something. Let's talk about the tag first. Where is that set? If we look at a coin, click on a coin, or any game object for that matter, a tag is one of the first properties listed on it. And you see a bunch out of the box that Unity gives you. You can create your own custom ones by doing add tag, my custom, let's just say orc, for example. Oops. Add that and say ORK. That adds it so you don't mess up the typing of it. In other words, you have this global list that you manage, and then on any game object, it appears in the dropdown. So all of my coins are tagged as coins. Perfect. So when we run over a coin, this method gets called in our player, and the collision game object tag, in other words, this game object's tag, is coin. So next thing we need to do is ask for how much that coin is worth. So because this is a component, all code that we have on our game objects, they're components. They're called script components. We can just ask for this particular component. We can say, do you have a component called pickup properties? And in order to do that, it's just like we saw when we asked for the rigid body. We get the game object. And all game objects, you can query for what components they have. So we just need the game object here. That's what we get from collision.gameObject. And then we call the very standard Unity API call, getComponent. And we use generics. We pass in the type of class we're looking for, pickup properties. If it's there, which I know it's going to be in this case, it'll return it. If not, it'll be null. So technically, I could make this code a little bit better in saying, if pickup properties is not equal null, then do this. However, in this case, I know that all my coins have it. So six of one, half dozen of the other. Once we get that component, pickup properties, we can just reference its coin amount. And then, in other words, that's whatever this coin amount is here, 10 or 5 or whatever we have it set to on this particular object. So that's how we get how much that coin is worth. And then we just call a little procedure called coin up, which increments our coin score. If we look at that, coin up simply just increments it by the amount of coins that we have. And then lastly, once we pick up that coin, we want to destroy it. How do we destroy a game object? We call destroy. And we give it the game object to destroy. We're not going to give it pickup properties because that would actually destroy the pickup properties component on the game object. We don't want to do that. We want to get rid of the entire game object, collision.gameObject. Now, one optimization we could do here is notice I'm referring to collision.gameObject 1, 2, 3 times here. So ideally, I could say collision.gameObject and assign that to a variable here and just really just do something like that. So we get it early on and we don't reference it over and over again. Then that might seem something silly, and if you're a standard .NET developer, you're like, well, these references don't really cost that much. But when you're dealing with Unity and you're transitioning between a managed code boundary to a native code boundary, which is where the engine runs, these transitions across those boundaries can add up. So in game programming, it's all about optimizations where we can optimize. And this is just one of the small ones that you can do here. So you're not referencing these multiple properties all the time. And I can fix this one up here as well. Cool. Get the pickup properties, get the coin value, and go ahead and increase our coin score and destroy that coin. Let's see if it works. Go back to Unity, it'll compile. Let's go ahead and run. There we go, coin. Now notice, because of the resolution I'm running at here, my score's pretty big. 30, 40, 50, perfect. All right, so I'm gonna save my changes, and picking up my coins looks pretty good. Now, one other thing that I just noticed is my UI system here is kind of scaling it's not really scaling, it's going pretty poorly. This is huge when I'm running my game. One thing that we can do is, on the canvas itself, there's a canvas scaler component. And right now, this says we're going to keep this a constant pixel size. So this is going to be, when I scale out my screen, let's say you're running on Windows and the user scales the screen, this bar is going to stay the same. If I run at different resolutions here, and I can do that just by changing the window here, notice how ugly that is. It doesn't scale. It doesn't look right. So on our canvas itself, we can actually change our canvas scaler to say scale with screen size. And we can choose a reference resolution. In other words, if our artist has given us like a standard background, a size, we can base everything off that standard size. And let's go ahead and try this. Notice as I make it bigger and smaller, there we go. I get a scaling health bar here. Perfect. So that works a little bit better as well. Get out of play mode and save my changes. That is it for this particular task. For our last and final task, task number 8, we're going to be adding a walk animation and then making that animation play. Now, we worked a little bit with the animation system so far. This particular task will take it kind of beginning to end to add a new animation. And so what we need to do is notice that the player is lacking a walk animation. He's still idle. So we want to use the walk animation. Creating an animation in Unity is pretty easy. Under the Sprites, Hero, Walk folder, notice there are 4 individual sprites that make up this character's walk animation. You can use a sprite sheet in Unity, and there's multiple documents online and videos that show you how to chop up a sprite sheet inside of Unity. It's a pretty automated procedure. In fact, just since we're on the subject right now, there's a sprite editor built into Unity. And in the sprite editor, you can slice it up into multiple slices so it understands there's multiple sprites per slice. However, in this case, we have individual images, which makes it super easy because all we do is we control A to select all of them, or you can just, you know, if you want to control click, however you want to select them. And if this was a brand new object in our scene, I would drag it and drop it into the scene. Now, we don't need to do that, but let me just show you first what would happen if you did, and then I'm going to undo it. So don't do what I'm going to do. I'm just showing you this for demo purposes. I'm just taking those 4 sprites and dropping them into the scene. And it says, okay, what animation do you want to create? We're going to call that walk. And there we go. It's created this character here. Let me go back after I play. That's walking. What exactly is a walk animation? Well, it's just at some point in time, we are changing the actual sprite that's being rendered. And so if you look over here on the sprite renderer component on this object, oops, our character died. So right here, soldier_walk. And notice it's cycling 1234, 1234, 1234. That's all that it is. The animation system is swapping these out. Well, what does that look like? Before I undo everything I just did, let me show you that. I'm going to go to Window Animation and make sure I can see this okay. Now, this Animation tab basically is showing us right now for my highlighted game object here, my soldier, there's a walk animation and it has four keyframes. In other words, at four points in time, we're doing something different. That's all a keyframe is. At some point in time, change a value. And Unity will highlight over here in red to show you what values you're changing. With each keyframe, let me advance on the timeline here. Notice we're starting out with walk one. At this keyframe, we're telling the sprite renderer to go do walk two, and then play walk three and walk four. We can preview it here by clicking play. Notice we're not actually playing our game, and we can only preview one animation at a time here, one game object at a time. So that's this object's animation. And again, it's just cycling through it here. So at runtime, that's what's going to happen. Now, when we go from idle to walk, we're playing the idle animation. And then we stop the idle animation, play the walk animation. So I'm going to undo this. Let me dock this window because we're going to come back to this. And I'm going to delete that character and just delete this and delete this. And now we're back to where we were. Why did I do that? Because I have an existing player in my scene already. And my player already has an animator component set up on it. So the first time you drag and drop in your scene, this will all be set up for you. This object already has it. And so to add a new animation, let me show you what I have existing. Currently, I have the death. And I can go from any animation to died. In other words, if I'm idle or if I'm attack, doesn't matter. I can interrupt that and go right to death. That's what this any state is. But as soon as this game object starts up, entry, I'm playing idle. That's my default animation. That's why it's orange. And as we saw earlier, we trigger off attack when we press the mouse button. Well, watch what happens when I take those walk individual sprites and I drag and drop them onto the player. So again, you just take the sprites and drop them right up onto the player. What animation do you want to call this? What are we going to store these keyframes in? Well, I'm just going to call it walk because I happen to be in the walk folder and I like consistency. There we go. Walk is created. I'm going to save my changes. And you'll notice walk was actually added in here. Perfect. Well, now we need to be able to use walk because right now, notice there's no arrows going to it. Nothing can get to walk. If you missed how I opened up this window, that's just the animator component. You go to the game object, the player, and you double click on its controller, its animation controller. That's this little state machine, this flow chart here. You just double click on it and it opens right up. So to create these arrows, we need really think of a triangle here. We're going to need idle to walk, walk to attack, and everything vice versa. So right click on idle, make a transition. Now we get this free floating arrow. We're going to dock it over on walk just by clicking on it. There we go. Notice it's docked there. I'm going to do the same thing going back to idle from walk. Right click, make transition, drop that back over on idle. Okay? Now we haven't set any parameters yet, which we'll get to there in just 1 second. I'm just going to set the first part of this up. Now we're going to go from walk to attack, and then from attack back to walk. All right. If we look at parameters over here, we are missing something. We have an attack, we have a death. Cool. Those work right now. But we don't have a walk value. Now, walk is not good as a trigger. Because trigger, think of those again as like a one-time value. You trigger death, that's a one-time value. Attack, you attack once and then it's done. Something like walk, that's a Boolean value. You're walking, 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 walking. That value's true. And then when you let go of the keyboard, you set that value to false. You'll learn kind of what the standards are here. You kind of get the idea that, oh, a jump animation, that's a trigger. It's a one-time animation. An attack is typically a trigger. Something like a walk or a run is typically a bool. So there's walk. Now, I'm idle. When I want to go to walk, I'm going to click on this transition and make sure that condition is when walk is true. So notice this arrow is highlighted. And in conditions over here, I click on add, and it populates all my parameters. I drop it down, walk is true. Cool. Now, when can I go from idle to walk? This is the whole exit time business that I don't like for this type of animation. I don't want an exit time. I want to be able to interrupt idle at any point in time. And transition duration is a quarter second. In other words, it's going to take me a quarter second to go between idle and walk. No, I don't want that at all. That does me no good in the 2D world. So I make that zero. Perfect. Now, if I scroll down a little bit, you can see I go right from idle right over to walk. Now, conversely, I can interrupt walk also at any point in time to go back to idle. So if I click on this, the first thing we need to do is make walk false for this transition. So the condition is walk false. Save my changes. Now, again, I don't want has exit time and I don't want a transition duration. So zero. So uncheck has exit time, transition duration zero. Now at any time I should be able to interrupt walk and go back to idle. In other words, anytime I let go of my keyboard, I go right back to idle. So those are set. Now let's look at going from walk to attack. Walk to attack is already set up from idle to, well, idle to attack is already set up. That's attack. The condition is attack. So I'm going to duplicate the same thing here. From walk to attack, let's add. Boom, it's the first one there, attack. Now, do I need to wait for walk to finish? Nope. Uncheck has exit time, make it zero. Now, when I go back from attack to walk, when is that going to happen? How do I know if I want to go back to walk or back to idle? And there's a couple different things. When you click on the attack state here, there's an order of operations. So basically, you will first go back from attack to idle, followed by the priority of attack to walk. So that's the order that you'll go in by default if there are parameters that will match either transition. In other words, right now there's nothing telling me when I should go back to walk. And same thing here, there's nothing telling me when I go back to idle. Which one takes precedence? Whichever one is first here. I don't want to leave it up to the order here, and by the way, you can drag and reorder those. What I want to do is say I can go back to walk when my attack is done, so I have an exit time at one. In other words, play 100% of attack before you can walk again. Now, this might give us some weird oddities in the screen where we're attacking and then still moving. That's possible, but we'll deal with that for now. So let's set our condition here to be walk is equal to true. And that means we can go back to walk. Once we're done playing attack, if walk is true, still true, we're going to go over here. So if they happen to have let go of the keyboard during their attack, then we're going to say, all right, go back to idle either just by default or when walk is equal to false. Let's be explicit about what we want. So walk, when walk is false, then we know we're going to be going back to idle. Exit time is one. We need to play 100% of attack, and I think we should be good to go with this. The one thing that we're missing is how we're going to set this value in code. We can debug it first. Even before we go to code, let's run and let's set our values here. Let's go ahead and say walk. There we go. We're walking. We're not walking. We're walking. We're attacking, and we're going back. Now I notice I'm kind of getting a little extra blip here, it looks. Maybe not. There we go. It looks like I'm getting an extra loop of attack. Let's just double check something here. So going from walk back to attack. My transition duration, I'm going to make that to zero. So I think what was happening is it's basically saying you had to play 100% of the animation and then start transitioning. So you're going to play a little bit of the attack again and then go to walk. So that doesn't make too much sense for what I want to do here. So let's go ahead and make sure that we're also all set there. Okay, same thing. We're all good. Let's debug this again. Pop that window out again. Go to parameters. Okay, let's see where we're at here. Gonna walk, attack. That looks perfect. And we're not gonna walk anymore. Let's just attack, attack. We're walking, and then we go to death. Cool. So it looks like everything works. Now we just need to set our walk value in code. So in order to do that, let's just go back to our player controller. And in our update method, the same thing we did with our simple player when we're reading our input here, horizontal, vertical, what we can do is at the end, we can set our walk boolean value. If horizontal is not equal to 0, or vertical is not equal to 0, means we've read input from the keyboard, we must be walking. That's it. We're just setting the value of walk to be true whenever there's keyboard input. That's all that line means. Now notice we flip the character too when we press left or right. If our horizontal is greater than 0, we're moving to the right. We can just flip our sprite. If you've been wondering about how we flip from the left to the right, the sword changes hands, we're just actually flipping that sprite. We're just rotating it by 180 degrees via this built-in flipX method. This is fairly new in Unity. You used to actually have to rotate the sprite or change its local scale to -1. Now they've got this flipX, which is great. Makes it nice and easy. So we're just flipping it back and forth depending if you're going left or right. So save my changes there. I did about 5 times. Play. And there we go. Okay, attack. Let's go and attack. And notice I can still attack and walk, but the two of them kind of mixed with each other, so it doesn't look so goofy. It's kind of hard to really notice that's what's happening. So I think this will be fine for what we want to do here. Perfect. And I actually noticed one little thing that seems to be a bug in this particular version. Notice that my camera follow has stopped working. The camera follow script is on my camera. And I've noticed that in this particular version, if that happens, restart Unity. Hopefully by the time you're listening, that's not an issue anymore, but I've noticed that a couple times in this one as I've been recording this. So just to note, and I will actually file that as an issue. Cool. Well, that's a wrap. That's everything here. We now have our simple little game, our Orcs with Forks. Now just keep in mind on our GitHub repository that we have the after one as well here. In other words, we've got the begin and end projects underneath source, begin and end. So check those both out and let me know if you have any questions. You can file any issues or pull requests if you want to make modifications on here as well. We're keeping an eye on the repository. And thank you very much. Take care, and we'll see you soon.